that admitted that.
Kind of stupid rental car right now. So I've got two sets of keys in my pockets.
Should we start?
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll go ahead and get going. We do have a quorum. Hopefully Terry will show up and join us here shortly. We'll go ahead and start with introductions. I'm Mike Odrin with Olson Engineering.
Jeff Riston, Moss Riston.
Jamie Housley with Jordan Remus.
Eric Lima, SJ Engineer.
Don Hardy, Bridge Raymond.
Rosie Schout, Develop Engineering.
Greg Schaefer, Development Engineering, Division Manager.
Peter Sullivan, from the Board of Commissioner Fox. Jose Alvarez, can you come in?
Jerry Alvarez, can you
come in? Paul Lane, from the Northwest Engineering. Gabe Dukes, take the instructions.
Great, thank you. Just a reminder that the meeting will be recorded and posted on the county's website, and that if you have any cell phones, to turn them off or set them to silent, please. Next item on the agenda will be to review and adopt the minutes, and if it's been reviewed, I will entertain a motion.
So moved.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Any abstentions? None seen? Greg, if you want to review upcoming events with us.
Upcoming events, month of October with the board, we have a hearing and three work sessions. The hearing is on routine matters. That's next Tuesday, October the 7th. That is an evening meeting, 6 p.m. The first work session is a budget and economic outlook. Following Wednesday, on Wednesday, October the 15th, 9:30 a.m., also a work session on alternative maps the week following that, October 22nd, 10:30. And finally, the work session, third quarter of the 2014 financial report, Wednesday, October the 29th, 10:30. For Planning Commission, we have a work session on rural industrial land bank introduction. That is Thursday, October the 2nd. So 5:30, that'd be this evening, 5:30 p.m. And then a hearing on the Steigerwald Commerce Center. That is Thursday, October the 16th, 6:30 p.m.
It appears there's also some amendments that are up for review on the Fifth Plain Creek area with regards to the arterial atlas, too, on both of those days.
Steigerwald's been pulled.
Steigerwald has been pulled?
Yep.
Staff, is there anything else that isn't on here that we should know about? Great, thanks. Just for everybody who's here, if you could be so kind as to either now or on your way out to go ahead and sign up on the sign-in sheets that are over here against the wall to my left. Let's see, any D member announcements? None seen. We'll jump right in. I don't see Marty.
I don't see Marty either.
So if that's the case, maybe we'll go ahead and skip to number three, the infrastructural percent deduction follow-up that Eric will go ahead and...
Can we skip that one, too, if someone wants to get back still?
Okay.
So,
this could get interesting. Mr. Housley's up next.
We're ready to go.
Cool.
We're ready to go.
Looks like he's excited.
So I think last meeting... One of the things that I wanted to talk about was just sort of the industry's view of where we think growth is headed in Clark County and how it relates to our buildable lands report here in the county as well as statewide. I had the opportunity about 3 weeks ago now to testify at the Government Operations Committee of the Senate as one of seven people in the state. Tasked with that testimony. And the question there was on buildable lands reports and whether or not we have some structural changes that need to happen with the Growth Management Act to account for things like market demand and unique circumstances that we went through with the recession. What's come out of that is an ad hoc work group we met for the first time, most of them in Olympia last week. We have a follow-up meeting next Thursday, where we'll be talking turkey and potentially bringing some changes to the legislature for structural changes to the Growth Management Act. A lot of the ideas I maybe I'll talk to them about the end, what is from the industry perspective, what we're seeing. But I kind of wanted to start. This is part of the presentation I gave up to start here. So in the 1960s, we started with about 93,000 people here in the county. And by 1970 census, that was up to about 128,000. So that represented a 37% increase over that decennial period. The other thing is I have to apologize about these maps. I did get these aerials from the county just when we decompressed them onto a PowerPoint presentation. The pictures kind of get a little bit spotty. So if somebody wants the aerials in color format, just please request and I can send you a link to them. But the purpose of that is to show sort of the slow urbanization of the county over the period of time. So in the 1970s, we went from that 128 to 192, which represents about a 50% increase in the 10-year period. The 1980s, that's when we experienced a pretty severe recession, you know, in the United States as well here in the Northwest. And we talked to a lot of my builder clients that remember that period. They remember it as a period of high interest rates and not a lot of stuff moving and a lot of mobility not happening. So we only saw about a 24% increase in population during that period. 1990s is sort of the heyday of Clark County. I believe at the time we were the fastest growing county in the country, also trailing with Clark County, Nevada. We saw about a 45% increase during that period to about 345,000 in 2000. And then this last period, we sort of had explosive growth at the early part of the decade, and then the recession hit. And so we only experienced about a 23% growth rate. So if we look at the 50-year average, this is sort of the point of this, we have a decennial growth rate of about 38.8% and an annual growth rate of about 3%. And what we have now, though, coming from OFM, is an assumed decennial growth rate of 11%. So that's a pretty significant decrease from what that has been historically. And an assumed annual growth rate of 112. And from my understanding of how OFM does the calculations is they base a lot of that on what has happened, particularly in the most recent five-year subset. And so one of the discussions going on in this ad hoc work group is whether or not those numbers are actually flawed or not, because we experienced a period from 2012 when those numbers were given. If you count back 5 years, you're right smack dab in 2007, which from the United States perspective were some of the slowest growth rate years, migration patterns in the country. There's a great paper that I think I attached to a letter that I sent to Oliver from the Brookings Institute that talks about migration patterns in the United States during this period, and effectively what Brookings had determined was that housing was frozen, or migration was frozen across the country, and that was due to a lot of different factors, whether people had upside down mortgages, that even if they wanted to sell, they couldn't get out of it. The job movement had ceased, and so people couldn't even move to other places to get jobs, and a variety of other factors. Also inbound immigration from other countries really, really tapered off during the recessionary periods, and that's for obvious, you know, sort of anecdotal reasons. Yes, Gary?
Did that Brookings Institute report mention anything about utility rates being lower?
It did talk a little bit about that, but obviously that has more of an impact, you know, 50 years down the road is sort of what they're assuming, not for like a more immediate 10-year period what they were looking at.
So for like a planning period, a 20-year planning period, that's kind of what they were headed towards?
Well, then if people were being born now or not being born now, they would probably be just reaching fertility age at the end of that 20-year there's some other papers from the Federal Reserve and some other presentations I've said I would be happy to provide those that talk about that aspect of it and how they view future household formation occurring in the United States. I guess the point with this, to me, is this has been our population growth in the county. And for me, for us to assume that we're going to be not growing at something like that versus what is being projected here seems a little bit disingenuous in that this is the experience that we've had over a long period of time versus what I view these numbers are coming from a very, very short snapshot of a period of not only history of our county, but history across the United States where migration essentially stopped. And so that was part of the point of that. One of the other things that goes along with it, and this is, I sort of wanted to bring this up as an aside because it did come up in the questions from a couple of the senators there. If they're going to move towards looking at substantial changes to the Growth Management Act, one of the things that they would like to drive at is what types of houses do our citizens in the state of Washington actually want. And I just happened to read the week before a report that's attached in a packet from Davis Hibbett's and David Hibbett's groups. And this was sponsored by Metro, Washington County, Clackamas County, the cities of Portland, the city of Hillsborough, the Northwest Natural Gas. Portland State did a lot of the research, the Home Building Association of Metro Portland, and the Realtors Metro Association. And this was the first sort of study of its kind that I'm aware of in our region that went out and surveyed residents in a 420 area, so it included Clark, Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah. And they actually asked the constituents what kinds of houses they wanted to live in. And if you go through the survey, the data is pretty interesting. It suggests that while 65% of the people that were surveyed had currently lived in a single-family detached house with yard, 80% of those people surveyed would like to have that as their living situation. And so we're already having a disconnect between what is reality and what folks are wanting. And there's some other interesting things in the report. You can peruse it at your detail or your literature, but people also said that they wanted a small yard, and commute times didn't really matter for them. And where this becomes critically important, I think, maybe not so much in Clark County, but for us as a region, as well as in Puget Sound, that a lot of the assumptions to accommodate even the low growth rates are predicated on the fact that we're trying to push folks into more multifamily living types of situations when constituents clearly don't want that. Oregon has got a different regime for how they go about doing their buildable lands reports. And these include market factors such as housing demand type and what builders such as Jeff are actually doing and hearing from their clients, what builders are hearing. And so we may be seeing that as a possible recommendation from this group as well going forward. So with that, from my perspective again, and from the Building Industry Association and the Realtors Association's point of view, we believe that this number is too low. We believe that some of the other assumptions that have gone into the plan thus far are erroneous. It doesn't mean that we won't be able to have the ability to revisit this again in 8 years, but there's some policy problems clearly with doing that, including not providing enough. A vision for infrastructure in the future, which will serve population. Because if this number does spike and we're having a scenario of catch up, we're essentially having a hard time building that infrastructure back up. So that's my presentation. With that, I'll take questions.
Were you missing? Did you have one more slide?
There's one that I deleted at the end. So I don't know.
But it's still in the packet.
It's still in the packet.
Still in the packet.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting slide.
Yeah.
The vehicle miles traveled right now is about equivalent to the year 2000. So we're not growing at the same rate of vehicle miles traveled, which doesn't suggest that people, they say they want single family, but the reality of it is the kids nowadays can't afford a single family house, and so they want to live close to in a multifamily. So that's the other part that he's going to talk about. So I had the joy of having a conference call with Mike Blanco from Commerce and the other Verbal and County Jurisdiction representatives on the phone, who heard you guys have your meeting up there. And what I pointed out to Ike and on the phone was that the Available Lands Report is not meant to be a market analysis tool for the builders. It's just the inventory of supply and demand, and the statute itself isn't set up as a tool for market analysis.
No, and I agree with you, and that's why I'm saying I think that there's some structural problems with that have to do itself on the buildable land side that needs to be addressed. That is, things are like these reports are worrying that a lot of people actually want to live in, because right now what happens with that is the policymakers, the county commissioners and their partner cities can't model things for the future that may not be what the constituents want. And I'll take the flip side of that on the affordability side. We saw the presentation that Sunoco and King and Pierce did on some of this stuff. And I think that they're, as a developer's representative, I think they're making a lot of very big assumptions about how much density they could get in and how much it costs to assemble properties and the reality of doing that. And there's some things, I think we just need to have an honest discussion in the state about that. So just on the buildable land side, that's my thing. It's all there.
Not so much of a question, but an observation, and that is that I think the period that, and by the way, let me thank you for providing this.
Yeah.
I also have spoken with some of those that participated or are participating in this conversation. What is striking, though, is that the period looked at is totally different from what OFM is looking at now. I have talked to their staff, and we met with them here at the county demographers, and queried them as to their methodology and the factors that they considered in their forecast. And in doing so, my concern was that their projection for Clark County appears to be low, given our historical trends. They recognize that. What they caution too is that the conditions that existed, if you want to go back to the 1970s and 80s and up to 90s, are totally different. You have an environment that growth was occurring. There was a lot of migration from South California, Oregon, and other places into Clark County. And not that those conditions will change, but they don't see that at least not in the next 10 to 15 years. I made their forecast based on economic conditions, migration, market conditions and other factors, fertility, the makeup of population, the aging of the population as well. So those were all the factors that they used in their recent population projection. And it's a forecast. They may be wrong. They were wrong in the past. But if you look back since the 2000 census, following their report but their forecast with the census, they've been pretty much on the mark. So I won't say that what you guys are doing is of concern to me, but I think it would be very, very prudent to look at the forecast and the factors that OFM considered in their recent state, not only Clark County, but statewide. Because, first of all, they do the forecast at the state level and then begin to, you know, look at local conditions before they do the allocation to the 39 counties in the state. So that's where I really would ask you folks to also take a look at, because I have probed them with county staff and others that know how to do this, make consultation to the Portland State Population Center, where I know some of the staff. So again, my question would be look at the methodology and the forecasting and the factors that OFM considered before we can really say that they're off.
And I think that's fair, Oliver, and from the industry's perspective, I guess we're starting to dig into those conversations. It isn't just a Clark County issue, but you know, the folks up in Puget Sound are moving forward with their plans right now. We're doing that. But based upon the analysis that we have looked at right now, quite frankly, from my perspective, OFM got very lucky that we hit a recession. That's the only way they would have hit what to make them look like they're on target, because otherwise they would have under. If we would have continued at the trend that we were in the early 2000s, Clark County would have continued to grow at a much higher rate than we even had forecasted for. That 3% wouldn't be very, very far off. I think last year here is sort of indicative of recovery that's taking place, and we experienced growth of, I think it was like 1.7. Yeah, so almost 1.7. So we're already, you know, I know obviously that declines over time, but that's just the start of recovering. So to me, there's probably 3% is probably too high. 1.2 is definitely too low. Probably somewhere realistically in the middle. Marty, you had a question.
Yeah, so I find it interesting on one of the survey questions about how big a yard do you want?
Yeah.
Which would be a proxy for how big a lot do you want?
Yeah.
So 70% want medium to small yards.
Yes.
So my own personal life is I was perfectly happy on a 7,800 square foot lot, actually more happy than on a 15,000 square foot lot. So what does that tell you about, you know, current zoning that we have in place? I mean, we have a lot of small lot residential development right now.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think...
Is that too small? We need more medium size, large size.
Too small. Yeah, you know, how do people define that too? A lot of people have ideas of medium are different than others.
My first home was on 6,000 square feet. My second home was on 7,800. Now this home that I'm at is
too big.
And I have two kids that can work, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of interesting policy implications from this report. I think, it, you know, again, from the industry perspective and the region's perspective, this is the first kind of report of its kind. And to me, this isn't the building industry or realtors just giving you anecdotal evidence of what their clients want. This is actual empirical data that was surveyed across this four county area.
Are we held to the OFM projections? So I think they had a range of 0.31 to 1.8 is what they had. I took that out of your slideshow presentation here. So are we held to that? I mean, when we do the comp plan, is that a set in stone range that we have to work within?
I think for right now, unless OFM goes and updates that with political pressure. I think that's what we're stuck with.
Well, the way the statute is written, that's what we have to use.
Yeah.
So unless the statute's
yes. So what about, they based this on kind of an average, and they just went back, and I might be wrong, but I think with Jameson and that, they revised 2013. So they originally projected 0.98%, and they came back later and said, no, for 2013, we have 1.69. So right there, is that our case? Okay,
well,
so what was that?
The deed, I believe it's 2005, deed at 20 years, and that was later revised. If you look at 2005 projections, it was much higher. I don't know what the percentages were for low, medium, and high. They revised that in 2012, and that's the number that all the counties updating their plan are bound to get.
So Jeff, we looked at the same number because we were talking about it. That was this, it was in an article about the actual projection of 2013 came in much higher, that the actual rate came in much higher than this projection. So maybe they never changed the projection. Because they didn't need to. Because once you have real data, why are you projecting it? You have real data. So, where was that 1.69? What were they saying? Do you remember what the context of that was?
That was just in the commerce data for their annual.
It came from LFM, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That could be a 1 year. I have to look.
Yeah, I think it is 1 year.
I think it's a
that
1 year.
That was the 2013.
2013, 1 year.
Yeah.
But reason for just a little
no,
bit.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I was kind of looking at, like, when we look at this chart, this is every slide, you know,
yes.
We had 2013 at 0.98, and we took this average, where the reality was 2013 at 1.69.
So that's a 1 year.
That was one year.
And it's typical. I'm not. I don't have any position of one more data, but we know it's typical. Population goes up and down, you know. You can look at it any way you want to look at it. At the end of the day, you look at what is the average of 5 years, 10 years, and so forth. Again, what OPM have done is just give us a projection, which again, they may be off, they may be on target, I don't know. But it's their projection. And to answer your question, we are bound to to their numbers. And that's why I started early. As I said, I started early. Medium will be asked that. When I first saw the number, it comes to me, and Ken Perot, who is the county designated demographer, we are the two that sees this, and we meet with them. We provide them local information that could influence them to revise their number before it becomes official. Three or four times we met with them, and they came back almost with the same forecast, and with the same issues that, you know, they could not be able, we couldn't convince them to or provide them adequate information to have them change their forecast. But they believe in their model. Right?
Yeah, they believe in their model. And
they do believe in their model.
They're sticking to it.
I believe in the street. So I guess from a going forward basis, anybody wants to bet me, by the way, on what the 2014 rate would be? I'm willing to take bets because I have a pretty good guess. But I think we'll continue to have that ad hoc meeting, and I'll give some reports back on that and let you guys know if anything gets recommended. Like I said, this has become an issue of statewide interest. I think there'll be some interesting discussions in legislature this year about there needs to be some changes to the act. And it's, you know, from a policy perspective, it's we're 20 years into it. It's probably huge to have some reconsideration for that.
So real quick, Jamie, before you wind it up, so what kind of implications, if any, does that have on the new comp plan that we're looking at here locally? Would any changes take place down the road as we look at it in the next 8 years or whatever, or is it something that is looking to be changed that could potentially affect everything here locally?
Well, everybody knows the legislative process moves at a quick pace. So my guess would be there probably won't be at least legislative changes to the act that would impact this update, but I could see some happening for the next update, and which really, in the scheme of things, isn't that too much further down the line. It's, I mean, you know, us that have lived through a few of these know that it just seems like we're constantly in these planning cycles. So,
okay.
So that's what I have.
Great, thank you.
Jamie, is there a month where you want to target to come back on the agenda, or
maybe like December?
December, okay.
Just as a segue to that, Mike's question, Jamie just had a thought. The buildable land supply piece of this, and I know there's a forecast for Old Town, but the buildable land supply piece, I guess the one part on the comp plan would be looking at that potential growth that would happen under certain designations, and that's maybe a thing to track in the comp plan update, is that that growth could theoretically be higher based on the land supply than that projection. So that's, I mean, that's, I think the implication is the zoning that ends up, the comprehensive plan designation and the zoning that ends up getting place, that's a big determining factor in this update. I think that's where the dynamics are of that. And so there may be actually, I understand there's actually additional land available beyond what is needed based on that projection. So I guess the question is, how does that get designated in this update? That's kind of the...
Well, I mean, I think at least what I've heard, and Oliver can correct me if I'm wrong, at least what I've heard in attending the hearings thus far on the Act or GMA update is that we're not likely to see any shrinkage of any urban growth area. I think that there's some limited expansions for Ridgefield, the center, and Battleground, or predominantly jobs. Basic land uses. I think what, from the industry's perspective, again, I think when you start compounding stuff like Eric's talking about with infrastructure and stuff, where if we do have a higher population and we can demonstrate that and the commissioners end up agreeing with us, then we could get into, or we change zoning to address maybe getting larger lots, then we may have a land problem. But right now, as the numbers stated, I don't think that's the case. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Good follow-up. Okay, I guess we'll move back up to number two. Marty's here now, and if he wants to give us an update on the fall biennials, if there are any.
So yeah, the last time I came to you, you know, we didn't really have a whole, you know, we didn't develop a tick list of things for biennial code amendments. Maybe at that time, and certainly since then, we do have some code amendments moving forward. They're really kind of one-offs. The saga of surface mining overlay continues, where we're now in the development regulation side of the issue. The board's already gone through the mapping exercise. They're looking at the policy changes in the actual development code. And that's been taking a lot of time. So that's moving forward. There was a work session a few weeks ago, and we're doing some follow-up work on that. Environmental Services has advanced a couple changes. One is a new wetlands rating system by Ecology. That should be moving forward this year. The new rating system from Ecology changes and is effective January 1st. We don't want folks to have to work in two systems. So the board was presented yesterday in a work session the changes to the wetland rating system. There are also some tweaks to the habitat conservation ordinance, very limited amendments on something to do with mapping, priority habitat and species, rather than referring to a paper map that we have on file, that we would digitally have that layer from Fish and Wildlife, and then some exemptions for previously approved development. And if you're, you know, an example would be you're adding, you know, a bonus room or a bedroom in a yard, right? And whether or not that would require a habitat permit. So those are the few things moving forward. Jan Zala is busy with the surface mining overlay policy and ordinance. We've had actually a team of people working on that, and he's also busy with project review. So I had not really looked at a laundry list of code amendments, and I've not heard, you know, a hue and cry that we need to make some code changes. So I figured for the fall time we would suspend them again, and maybe do a winter, you know, know, sometime in February, March.
Is that when these other is that when the environmental services items will also be addressed?
No, they're going to be moving forward this year.
Okay.
They've already got time with planning commission scheduled, I believe, this evening. Yes. No. November.
Okay.
The weather rating system they need in place by the end of the year.
Okay. I would assume, like to hear about what kinds of changes those are taking place, at least get an overview of impact.
Go to the grid, the county grid, right? And there's a PowerPoint presentation that you can access.
And we have Kevin Tyler coming in next month. He's already scheduled.
Great. Wetland rating system is interesting because they had statewide they had done some analysis on category 1, 2, and 3 wetlands,
mm-hmm.
and how many, the buffer width, and that's where it all comes down to, is how many remain, how many were increased, and how many were decreased. And a vast majority of them stayed the same, category 1, 2, 3. I think there's one area that they go up, but everything else goes down. So in terms of buffer width.
Oh.
Yeah, Kevin Tyler contacted us about 2 months ago, and he felt like this meeting, October's meeting, was just a little bit premature, but definitely wanted to hit November. He thought November was a good time to come in. So.
Right. And then as far as the development standards for the surface mining overlay, I know that we've seen that before, maybe like a year ago or
right.
a few, 8 months ago or whatever. Are those generally the same? I know that they there was some heartburn when those were originally presented to the shareholders, and I don't know if those are going to be significantly different than what we've seen before or not.
Well, there are from the planning commission's take, and then there's some neighborhood groups involved and with staff. I mean, I'm not sure, are we going back to the board?
No, we are going to the planning commission next month.
Okay.
November
16.
I think it's the 16 of the. Yes, I think it's the 16. I don't have the document.
With new code or?
With the code.
With the development standards.
Yeah. The new development standards.
Yeah.
I
think we would all be interested in seeing those again. I know that.
It's on the grid.
It is on the grid.
Everything about it is on the grid.
And also on our website, if you go to our community planning website, go to land use, and then go to surface mining, the proposed code language is in there. Don't want to go into details, but
right.
I think the focus is on monitoring and enforcement. That's the only section that is new.
Okay.
All other policies and code standards have gone through the planning commission and hearing. So the what is going to the planning commission is limited to the enforcement and monitoring section. There's one more change that I think we think is significant, that we ought to have a public hearing, and that is I don't have all the details, but one use that was permitted outright, now it's going to go to conditional use permit again. We'll see how that goes when it goes to some vetting through the public hearing process. But those are the only two limited areas that the Planning Commission will be considering.
Okay.
So, Oliver, those will be just new mines on surface, mining overlay.
That's what I thought.
That's what they just started. Got it.
New mines, what about the expansion of existing?
That's a point of contention for some folks.
Whether or not they would be subject to the new development standards
right.
or not.
Yes. Or whether,
Okay, great.
So on the presentation from yesterday, the rating system currently is like on a 100-point scale.
Mm-hmm.
Ecology's new rating system goes to a 30-point scale, right? And they did this comparison. 60 sites remain unchanged in terms of the category wetland it goes to on a new rating system. 30 sites go to a lower category, 21 sites go to a higher category. And then in terms of buffer change, the the anything that was 24 to 70. No, it's 5-point scale. They increase 10 feet, 15 feet, 20 feet buffer width. So
Marty, as far as the critical area ordinance to be updated as well, I know the ratings.
No. So this is just the wetland rating system. Just the rating system for wetlands.
That's an interesting question.
We have with the 2016 update requirement under GMA, we look at critical areas and make sure we still have best available science.
And I understand that part. There's an intensity level that we could talk more about.
Low, medium, and high.
Yeah, that part will stay the same, I'm guessing.
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
And the ability for the other flexibility, buffer energy, buffer reduction, mitigation, none of that changes the rating.
This is just the rating system.
Just the rating system. Normally they come out together.
The rating system and then the attendant buffers, but in terms of buffer averaging.
So that none of that stuff, the ability that doesn't change, it's going from letters to numbers and more.
Much narrower band.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
But you don't want, I mean, the idea is, and this was made, the point was made yesterday, is if you have somebody applying next year, you don't want them applying with two different rating systems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If they have to get some from an ecology, you want one system.
Mm-hmm. So, you know why ecology decided
to do this? Because they could.
Yeah, nothing better.
They've been in the business of doing this for decades, so. I think they want to make an easier rating system.
It's the borderline cases that are probably the main concern. Did they get a
different one? Core, is it going to be consistent with core out there? Because already it's not always consistent. Especially one of the buffers, especially.
So, right. You can access this through the grid. Yeah. It was all put up yesterday.
Not sure.
October 1st work session.
Well, maybe we should give some of our wetland consultants that call and get their take on it.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and do that. I'll send out and see what they've heard and have it
report
back, and I'll let
Kevin,
you guys
does
all know.
A presentation.
Pardon?
Invite him to the meeting when Kevin does a presentation.
Okay.
The resource company, who?
ELS. You guys.
I'm sure that they're aware of this change.
Oh, I'm sure they are too. We just haven't heard what the impact of it is. Or if they've delved into it long enough to know what the impact would be, because they're so busy right now. Okay, very good. Thanks, Marty.
So just one last note on this.
Yeah.
You know, we will, we have historically fielded issues to put on a biennial code list, and I've not heard a hue and cry on that other stuff. So.
Right. I think there's some errors or stuff that I've heard about, but nothing substantive.
All
right. Good. Thanks. All right, Eric.
So which one was
your turn. We're on number three.
Infrastructure percentage?
Yep.
Okay. So we talked about this briefly before. That Dave took a position that the infrastructure percentage was low. And the board came back with some information basically saying that they based it off of Ron's memo. And from talking to Ron last time, I didn't really let him answer, but from our conversation, that memo wasn't necessarily intended to set the infrastructure percentage for the comp plan. Maybe that's not the case. So that's how you got dragged into this, was that that letter, which I have a copy of somewhere here, was what they used to justify the 28%. So for action on this board was, what do we do at this point with this new information? I actually have some additional information to submit on how that 28% came to be from the beginning, back in 2000. But then you can address the memo you prepared.
I was asked to weigh in on the position that that the existing assumptions for the vacant buildable lands model were inaccurate or not valid. And what I had written to Oliver wasn't intended to be used to change those in any way or to really say that they were valid. It was intended to say, if we want to know if they're valid or not, we really need to do an analysis to prove whether or not they're valid, looking at examples that we have. Throughout some case studies, for all of us just saying, here's just some random samplings of we've seen, and then the memo that was put together by, I think it was the that went to the board, also had some examples in there as well that, you know, kind of painted a different picture. So it was really more for context than for anything else. I think at this point, what we talked about last time was if we're really interested in either validating or invalidating assumptions for public infrastructure in the model, probably need to come up with a defensible way to look at it.
The challenge is there's not a lot of stuff built into the new stormwater regulations, especially in those areas where our letter basically says that, you know, that 27.7% is a reasonable number in most parts of the county. And we kind of split it up into those soil groups where you look at you know, poorly draining, moderately draining, excessively draining. And excessively draining soils, it's adequate, if not even conservative. Yeah. And on the middle soil group, it probably is adequate as well. And the reason it's adequate, it's not that it doesn't take more land, it's that you have a choice. And in those soils, LID usually makes sense. And you could probably fit it in 28% but it's just going to cost more money. And that's just how our memo says. And then the real question is, in the areas where it's poorly drained soils, where LID doesn't help you, even if you LID, you're still going to build a pond. In those areas, we felt it was low. We gave examples of that. So in our memo, we didn't say that the 27.7 wasn't adequate in some cases. It was more geared towards the areas in poorly drained soils. Ironically, those are also the areas in the urban growth boundaries on Richfield battleground where we're adding land. So when we're looking at that, in those cases, I don't know how we do it, we average, it gets a little more complicated, but because those are the areas we're looking at now, we're no longer looking in the center of the city of Vancouver, it's time to look at the 27.7 and raise it. Some other information that we dug up from the last comp plan is how they came up with the 27.7%. And it came back in 2000, previously, that the last one, they used 38%. And the city of Vancouver lobbied the county basically saying that that was too high, and the realistic number was about 28%. And that was based on a 4 square mile radius. Yeah, 4 square mile radius in the city of Vancouver. As you know, that's all excessively drained soil. So they did a bunch of data in here. I have that letter, I can give it to you, and if Oliver maybe is really, I think, who's following up on it. That's where that came from. So trying to figure out, we talked before, where did that come from? Is it just pulled out of a hat? Mm-hmm. It wasn't pulled out of a hat. It was from data generated. They used a very narrow sample in the city of Vancouver, and we applied that countywide. Now we're looking at different areas. So, in my opinion, I don't know if the board, you know, our memo supported that as well, saying that we probably need to look at expanding that now that conditions have changed, stormwater ordinance have changed, the area of development has changed, and the 28% is no longer the most accurate number based on that information. So, that's kind of where we're at on it. I don't know if we could change our position, but I guess it would be nice to maybe you know, look at that with the board again, and they basically used this memo to say, hey, looks like we're set in stone, we're using the 28, our data shows that that's adequate. And again, I think it's being taken a little out of context, especially when we look at the examples in here, and most of them are under the old storm ordinance, and many of them are in the either moderately draining or excessively draining soils.
And I think there are cases, if we looked at it, where it would be under and where it would be over. Yep. I think from a road infrastructure perspective, it's a little more predictable, and that number is also the majority of the 28. So we did poke around a little bit with some other counties to see if they were changing. Other counties that have been under the new standards that Ecology put out in 2007 permit. I didn't see any examples where other counties were changing their assumptions for their models. Maybe they're already high enough. It's not something that we typically do. But
did you know what their assumptions were? Did they tell you that?
Well, it was mainly just pulling data from websites. And yeah, I think it's in there. I didn't really
I think that would be important to know.
So,
yeah, whether they were already high enough to accommodate the new standards or not.
Right.
So, yeah, and that, some of that's in the back of it. Someone may say that Pierce County plans for 20% land for stormwater use. Where we look at ours, we had a 20%, I think the way that 28%, I don't remember how the 28 is, 27.7. But the way we kind of figured was like, I believe the 20% is roads. And then the stormwater percentage was based on that 7.7. So if Pierce is using 20% for stormwater, that puts it almost at 40%. In other areas, they say they range between 1 and 15. So if you look at that, I guess that 7.7 is right in the middle of that 1 to 15. But in the soils that we're expanding our boundary, like it's probably closer to that, you know, 12 to 15 range. So.
Yeah, you know, working in these assumptions for the model is not something that I've done or our group has typically done. And so one of the things I said to Oliver was, whoever's in charge of the assumptions for the model needs to be comfortable with whatever information they're going to use to change the assumptions. And as you pointed out, Eric, you know, it was used before on a very small scale example in the city, and we went from 38 to 28.
Yeah.
So if the information that this board has provided to the county commissioners, whoever's going to change the model is comfortable with those examples, then I see no reason, at least from our perspective, why that would happen. Why that wouldn't happen. It's something that we do. I haven't heard from anyone that the information that I provided to Oliver for some context was sort of neutralizing the recommendation from the D. That's news to me.
So that is, I think, what happened.
No. If I may jump in with your permission, Ron is correct. The information that he provided us were never used to neutralize the or any other information submitted relative to the infrastructure deduction as was used. Ron characterized the way we presented the memo to the board. There was additional study done by our GIS, and that information is also available and was provided to the board. Again, looking at samples in some cities that have applied with the new stormwater regs to see what exactly is happening. And as you can tell, maybe again because of the recession or other factors, there's been very little development that have occurred to really generate what I may call a large sample. And all that is in the presentation that we made to the board. I will also add that the 27.7%, I have some of my staff here. It was originally, I believe, in 2000 and maybe 1994 plan, and maybe in 2004. It was originally 25% for residential. Remember, you have two categories, residential and industrial. So if you combine both, what you have is more than 40%. So don't really ignore that factor, because it is key. In 2004, I recall a series of conversation and studies that was presented, not necessarily maybe by D, but by Jerry Olson, that you know recommended 38%. And the cities, particularly the cities and the county, reviewed that with the board. And with input from the cities, the board looked at, including the report submitted by the city of Vancouver and others, and settled on an average of, given our own work, an average of 27.7%. That's how that came about. Again, this is data-driven type of work. Ron is correct, and what we are asking for, because I cannot alone recommend to the commissioners to change any of these planning assumptions. If it's regional, whether it's persons per household, whether it's other planning assumptions. That's, when I say it's regional, it is all the cities and the counties coming together and agreeing on doing a study, particularly on those data-driven assumptions. Oliver cannot change it. I cannot go to the board and have the county change it without input from the cities. And what Ronald advocated and I agree is, if this issue is one that needs to be changed, I think it might make sense to bring a group of people together to really do a sensitive review. My email to you, Eric, is not so much to disagree with what you submitted. My comment to you was that the sample, the area was relatively small, and I cannot convince the cities to use that to come up to an average for the entire county. The cities will not support that, and I have to make that very clear. I have a meeting with the cities. I meet with them every month. I have a meeting with them next month. This issue is on our table. We will review that and see where they want to go. But it is not something that I alone will push the board to change. So recognize that I'm not, it's not a pushback on the board. Ron's memo was very clear. It was a very few sample. I make suggestions on how we can go forward with this. Our GIS also weighed in. We haven't really seen we haven't really started implementing our new stormwater regulations in the county to see that the development of our code recently took advantage of that. So you have some issues with that. But if you put that aside, I think going forward, this is one that we may have a group of folks that, whether it's for the city, county staff, and the take a look at and see what we can come up reasonably to agree on. I will only say that I cannot change any of the planning assumptions, not at all.
Okay. Just to comment on that, the challenge we have with the sample size is that there's just not the sample size out there, and we really can't come up and give you data that doesn't exist. What we're trying to go with, the stormwater isn't even in place yet. We don't have a lot of stuff that's been designed under that in those types of soils. To tell you the truth, a lot of stuff hasn't been designed into the port of those types of soils because they're not feasible right now. The market's not there. People have invested in the stuff that is in better soil types, where they're not eating up 40% of their site by stormwater infrastructure. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't pencil out anymore. Those properties are sitting there, vacant. I can say we're doing a lot of projects right now. We're doing very little in Battleground because of that. We're working a lot in Richfield, which is on legal stormwater. We're doing stuff in Parks and Clark County that have those, Parks and Camas, that still have the other stormwater ordinance. We're doing very little in those areas because it's not going out because it is a higher infrastructure. So our data set is low. So what we did is we looked at the small set we can. We have five projects that have been built in those soils in the area. And then we looked at some theoretical examples, some prepared by us, some prepared by the county. So look at in those examples that were presented, there were calculations that goes up, what are the unchanged structural signs there. So with the data we had, with the time limit we had, that was the best information available for us to make that. And I want to make it clear, this is not countywide, this is in those soil types. It just happens to be in that way. I don't know what the next steps are. Yes?
Can we look at the media land model? Because more than half of the growth is going to occur in the Vancouver UGA. Mm-hmm. So, the growth that's going to occur in Battleground isn't going to move that number a whole lot because it's just a smaller number to start with. So, if you ask you go forward, you might want to look at that and see what the actual percentage of that model is.
And I think what you're
I like that idea. I think what we should do, if I was going to say working together with this, this is to basically a soil type. If there was a way that GIS could come up with a number of areas in like overlay the soil types by the area in the UGA,
I'm sure they can.
If we come up with a weighted average, we probably have the best data we can get. I think 27.7, we already have the data to back that up in those soil types in the and it's prototypes, probably closer to the data that we show here, which is maybe closer to 32 to 35. We take a weighted average based on the land in those areas. We can probably come up with the best we're going to do with the data we have.
Maybe that's something. Maybe that's something you could follow up with Bob on and see if that's something you could put together. James, did you have something to
say? Yeah, I think Jeff and I were having a little bit of a sidebar, and I think we volunteered ourselves. We'd be happy to go talk to the other cities and call their data, their recent experience, of what they're seeing on the ground, and try to ascertain what they're seeing there. Because I know that the development that Joel Sterling was at NC site in, he went around, our percentage was much significant higher, and that was a predominantly dry part of the city. So I would imagine that they're going to have different experiences than others.
Also, talking population, certainly. Things like that, too. You brought up a good point, Oliver, that it's a regional discussion, and so perhaps we can try to help out with that.
And so we need to get the data set in order for what we're recommending to be. Ironclad? I don't know. Is the memo that came out from the city ironclad? It was the only information that was out there, I think.
You mean going back to 2000?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the example?
Well, did go back when we updated the plan in 2007 and looked at what the development was, and it was within those ranges, so that's why we moved forward with the development.
Yeah. And that's fine, because the ordinance hasn't changed yet.
Yes.
From our
So those circumstances, I think, justify taking that look at it.
Okay, well.
I'm based off of this. I don't know. You probably have this in your own files, but.
He'd love to have more paperwork.
I think Oliver had a good point, too, in talking about before we start going mining data, just because this is what we do, we answer a lot of questions with real data. It would be good to get a group of people together and talk about what does that analysis look like.
Okay.
Before we run around and people spend their time, you know, we should know what data we're actually after. So what are we, I don't know what you're going to do with the data before you go get it. Mm-hmm. It would be worth that discussion. We could agree on, you know, likely some sort of stratification. The hard part, again, what Eric's talking about, and I totally get, is there are specific examples where those infrastructure assumptions don't hold,
yes,
both high and low. From, you know, what the model is supposed to do at a regional level, how much do you pull that number around and match particular areas? That's an interesting discussion about how much do you want to isolate particular areas that might develop in the future and really gear the model towards those areas is something that we would need to discuss before we go out and start grabbing examples.
Yeah. See, we're engineers, and economists do this kind of stuff all the time. They look at the best guesses they have, and they compile a bunch of data, and they make an assumption. Us being engineers, we're just wired to be. We need absolute numbers for all these, and we want to see real examples. And of course, we don't have to. We're projecting into the future. So, we'll see some economists, us engineers, and come up with the best guess we can. So,
Eric, to wrap up this conversation,
yes.
To stay on schedule, it sounds to me like there's been some volunteers to get together, both on staff side and on DEEP side, to at least narrow the focus down a little bit more, find out what the data is that needs to be collected and analyzed in order for staff to then go back to the commissioners, correct me if I'm wrong, in order to say, hey, by the way, we have this based on this information, but we have new information, more current information, regardless if it encompasses everything or not, but then we also have buy-in or discussions with the other jurisdictions around, the cities around here, to be able to then forward this movement. Because it sounds like it started, we all know what it is in practice,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we should necessarily back away from that we need to take the necessary steps in order for this to become something that can be used to make the change that we're looking to, I think, have changed. Am I on the ball there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Is that something, Eric, that you can kind of spearhead and follow up on, or Jeff or Jamie? Or
let's say Oliver and I can go back and forth. I'm curious how the county would like to see it happen. Is this something where we prepare another position paper, or is it a conversation and maybe working together to come up with a response to all the data we have now?
And maybe that's a discussion that needs to take place after you all get together and sit down and say, hey, what kind of information can we provide?
Yeah.
And will that actually work?
I think there's a methodology. If this is the, I mean, if the data is being developed, I think it's really valuable. But as how do we track that over time? I think that's a critical question as well. And I think that that is important as the data we have now is the tracking, so that the next plan update, that number is completely fleshed out.
Yes, not to deliver the issue. That's why we had agreed at some point to put some, call it measurable data or something to be monitoring over time to see what is happening. So that informs you going forward what type of changes you need to make. We had that in the 94 plan, and that was the first plan monitoring. The key indicators, if you remember or recall, and then in 2004, the powers to be said, take it off, because we had the section 215, which required us to do greater balance evaluation. So we took out the key indicators of the comp plan, not necessarily doing the monitoring again. But to Don's observation, that's really what we need to be doing going forward, collecting this data, knowing actually what is happening on the ground. That informs you next time you're doing this, here's what's, you anticipate, here's what's going to go on. You know, as we bring land into the urban growth boundary, particularly in rural areas, the dynamics changes. You inherit more problems, lack of load, other necessary infrastructures. Maybe, you know, you can say, yeah, this area just really, there's nothing there. Let's just do something totally different. In the urban area, you won't build you won't build another planning expressway. We know that. You won't build other parts, you won't build what typically would build elsewhere with some of these rural areas in. I'm gonna stop there.
Okay, great. Thanks. So I would assume that within over the next few months that that can take place. This isn't something that I see resolving itself in a few weeks. So we'll just ask you to come back and give us updates and see where we're at. Okay, very good. Thank you. Moving on. Jeff?
Yeah.
Final plan process?
Yeah.
Kind of with you, and I would assume kind of with you and Diana, were you involved? Have you been involved with final plat? And I don't know, Caroline, have you been involved with that too? Okay. Jeff, do you want to just kind of give us an update as far as where we are with that? I know you guys just recently met. Like,
we did. We met two days ago or something?
Yeah,
we met Tuesday, just in the nick of time. I apologize for that crazy summer, but and we had a great, really productive meeting. It's final plat's an issue that, unlike some of the other issues today, that are I think less contentious here, a little more workable, and actually came out of the meeting with some really good solutions that we can implement fairly quickly. In fact, some were immediate by communicating. So the purpose of the meeting was to go back to kind of regroup. There was a working group out of Dean back in August 2013 that met, so we kind of regrouped and took a look at that just quickly, and then assessed how the plat process is working today, and then identified areas for improvement. And I put out, and I'll circulate it when we finalize it, I put out a draft recap of the meeting to all the people that were to the people in the working group. And when we finalize that, we'll send it to Dee. But there were some really good things that came out. We identified areas that could use improvement. One of the first things that had the best impact right off the bat was that some of the people, the title people there that work on these, the vast majority of the plats, didn't realize that you could make appointments down at the permit center. Mm. So they've been experiencing some pretty big wait times dropping in on the permit center. So that was just great, just getting that communication out there and letting them know that they could make appointments. And that'll help them not have to sit around to turn in plats. The areas that we identified for improvement that just were brought up at the meeting was faster communication back from staff, electronic distribution of files, talking about the staffing and levels of staffing, turning in the plat materials to the county where fees are involved, and turning in the plats, the subsequent materials where fees aren't involved, and how you do that.
the ability to kind of keep the all the layers of the plat moving, kind of multitask the layers moving simultaneously and not holding it up over one technicality that maybe is missing, you know, because there's kind of multitasking, as we put it, dealing with minor technicalities and the conditions, the hearing examiner's decision or whatever, there's rather than going to post-decision review, seeing if we can deal with some of the minor ones on administrative level, timing of Mylars to the Board of County Commissioners, processing and review of building permits pending the recording of the plat, and then we talked about the review of as-builts, and then the fact that sometimes, and this one we didn't really have a solution to, but the fact that sometimes new issues come up late in the process, which always happens, but new issues come up late in the process. So we did come up with a lot of good solutions to immediately pursue. So that just quickly going through the solutions that we discussed, but just to continue to emphasize good communication. One thing that came up about to improve electronic distribution of files, we need to look at improving community development's access to plotters and scanners. I think Marty and Chuck are to work on that so that we can maximize electronic distribution of files. So I think Community Development and Permit Center has access to a plotter up on the third floor, but not a scanner, if I'm correct. So there's
the large format.
Large format scanner, right. So that they can get red lines back in electronic and distribute red lines in electronic, which the majority, I think, of people still prefer electronic. You know, it makes it move faster. There are some people that still want to work with paper, so we need to work around that. But so Marty was going to look into, and Chuck were going to look into that. The continued communication awareness of the ability to make same day or next day appointments. Then Chuck was going to look at the ability to kind of set up, I think just Chuck and Diana and everyone were going to kind of look at the ability to set up kind of overflow staffing or other ideas. We have a bat line, I guess, in engineering to receive plats on the same day, on same day appointments. And emphasize the importance of executing multi-layer final plat process. Exploring examples of where problems we've experienced, minor problems, so where we've been getting those minor technicalities that may or may not require post-decision reviews. There have been some examples discussed where I guess someone had to go back to post-decision review and maybe didn't need to. And so taking a look at the examples, seeing if we can deal with it either within Marty's current authority or looking at giving Marty some additional authority in code. A big one that Marty personally challenged me on, I believe, is to see if we can get the Board of County Commissioners to sign the Mylars when they approve the plat.
I talked to Commissioner Mielke yesterday.
So did you really?
There's a heads up, and Jeff Riston will be contacted.
don't steal my thunder. No. I tell you what, I will be absolutely flabbergasted if I can't get the commissioners to agree or the chair to agree that as he's walking out of the hearing room or contemporaneously with approving the plat, that he'll just sign the darn thing so we don't lose a day or two running around. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. And if you want to prove that, then we might as well scrap the rest of it. I won't say that. that'll
remember, we're being recorded.
That'll be that's all right. Fair warning, I'm on the way. I'm going to see if he's in after this meeting. Work on the process to shorten timing of to load the plat in the system after recording, or to explore some other way to front load or allow some building permits to go through review. So Diane's already been great at getting. I guess when she finds out it's recorded, she calls survey. Survey goes and picks it up, and they do everything to get it over to the county. It takes the county 2 or 3 days, which is that's their goal to load it all up in the system. Right. Is there something we can do to either speed that up, which they've already taken steps to speed that up, because it's taken over. You know, we weren't sure exactly, but I know we had one that took over a week, I believe, before you can start getting building permits, and/or allow building permits to go and go. Start the review process earlier. This is another one to allow first review of as-builts to be paper review once we get a punch list. So that's something that would really help probably gain about, you know, a week if not several days. You go to a punch list,
If you have to wait till your, if your punch list, most of your punch list, if it's, and most of the time they are, if it's all technicalities, kind of clean up stuff, doesn't affect the plat, then Ali or whoever can review the paper plat to the paper as-built to the, am I getting that right?
Yeah,
right.
To the plat.
Thanks.
Earlier. Yeah.
And then when the punch list is done and completed, signed off on, and then do the final review and do the Mylars. And that ought to save a lot of time. Because that punch list can take several days to a week or depending upon what it is. So that was something, another.
Are those items on the punch list things that need to be inspected in the field or?
At the end of the day, they need to be inspected, but quite often it's a, you know, might be a missing, you know, a storm grave or, you know, sweeping the street, some touch up to striping. I mean,
it wouldn't affect the plat.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all things.
Curb. The underground utilities, which have been in
breaks.
Really what we're looking for.
Repair curbs. Right. I mean, all what I've experienced most of the time when you get down to the final punch list is it's things that are not plat related. But some, we need to come up with a procedure for someone to make that call. Is this, you know, whether it's Nikki or Diana or come, you know, collaboratively make that call, is that punch list non-critical to the plat? And then we move forward with that. There was just a quick, it doesn't really affect plats, but the right now the inspectors don't sign off on the punch list. It's just kind of verbal, so we don't get a confusion, I guess, with the completion of construction. And so we're going to provide, that's just something that it doesn't really, it affects plats. It certainly helps people that are working on the plat and the developers, engineers, and everyone to know the punch list has been signed off rather than communicating it verbal. So we're just going to put a little initial or something and complete it, but short of completion of construction. Continue to emphasize and communicate the use of template legal documents wherever possible so that you don't have to get mired down in the prosecutor's office having to review HOAs and CCNRs. Communicate that the maintenance bond, this is a big one too, can be pursued early in the process of the construction bid. I don't know if a lot of people know that, but to, you know, we can pursue, for the most part, and if there's major changes down the road, it may have to be re-looked at, but for the most part, the county will look at construction bids to come up with your bond.
Rather than the cost of quantities.
Right. So it you know, that saves you a lot of time. If you have to wait all the way till the end of construction to start getting bonds, they're getting better, but sometimes you can get held up getting a bond just from the bonding company itself. So you can get that process. The more you can front load the process, both from the county standpoint and the private standpoint, the better and quicker it will be. So we came up with some really good solutions, a lot of which I think are not high hurdles to jump at all. We're going to get together in the near future. I don't know, probably
a couple weeks. Maybe?
Yeah, you know, something like that. We're going to see what your guys' timing was and try to get together again, bring the group together again, and then we'll report back.
Kind of finalize everything then.
Great. But there's, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more. We still want to talk a little bit more. The idea about staffing and staffing levels. One idea came up again, and I know that it needs to be talked about, is a dedicated final plat person. And or a one point of contact. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the day when there was a lot more plats going through, there was Karen who did this. You know, you just had one person who did it. That's the way they did it. They had one point of contact. Diana's terrific in the fact that she's kind of the ad hoc, at least when I run plats through, she's kind of the ad hoc. She takes, you know, command of the thing, but it's not official. She just does it because she wants to see things move through. The general consensus really was that since the meeting back in 2013, the process has improved. So we're just to give everyone a pat on the back. The process has definitely improved, and also we
see other improvements along the way.
What's that?
We'll see more improvements.
We'll definitely see more improvements along the way. I think it was a good, productive 2 hours just to come up with these solutions and follow through on them. And I think, you know, Clark County's also, we're going to take a look at other urban counties and see what their process is and see how we stack up.
Okay.
But in general, I think Clark County's doing a pretty good job.
Was there any discussion with, or did there even need to be any discussion with the county surveyor as part of this process? Then the county surveyor reviews the plats also, produces their own set of red lines, and is that something that's still, the paper, his paper copy that comes back to the consultant, is that, again, the only paper copy? Or is that something also that could be scanned and included in with that digital material?
There was some discussion on that. I don't know if
the other... surveyor, they want a hard copy, so...
And that's understood.
Yeah.
But then after they make their red lines...
Then we scan it and send it out as part of the red line packet.
Okay, good. Along with planning and engineering.
So everyone that was here and just jumped in, I took all my pages of notes and compiled them, but that's...
A 30-second follow-up.
Yeah.
Chuck and I already met. We met this morning, or this afternoon, and we kind of outlined some things on follow-ups from the meeting Tuesday. One was about staffing, and one was about an idea where when we get the final plat, the Mylar comes in and one copy that's a print copy. And then we could get a second print copy that will go down to the permit center to be worked up so that when the plat is approved and signed, we will have done that quote plat workup. So it's conceivable that you could get building permit, apply for building permits the day it's approved or the next day that it's approved.
That would be
so time span then is when it gets into the GIS and Property Information Center. So I asked Bob Poole, what's that time? It's still, a few days to a week. And part of it was that some people submit digitally, but they don't. There's no standardized way, so just takes a little bit.
Okay.
But that's one idea that came out of the meeting since Tuesday afternoon, and Chuck and I talked about it this afternoon. Did he mention anything about it?
We talked about it this morning.
One more way.
Yeah, we've got three.
Making it more expedient.
I think
that would be great. Did I miss anything?
I don't think so. The cost and quantity thing is. Use your bid, but fill out the cost of quantity.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still goes, yeah.
But based on the bid.
So we give that out at pre-con.
Okay. Good. That's great. Thank you all for doing that. Will you come back in November and give us a brief update, or send that list out in advance so that we have a chance to review it?
I sent out a draft to review, but then I will send out the final.
Yeah, I mean, after they've met one more time.
After we've met one more time, but I'll send out the final one because I'm hoping everyone will kind of take a look at it, and because there's some good communication and solutions right in that draft recap.
Okay.
To communicate to whoever.
Very good. And it's probably what, 10 or 15 minutes next time around.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. Next up, the stormwater and erosion control fees. Boy, who wants to go first? Andrew's not here, so that goes down to Greg and Eric and Diana.
Do you want me to take that, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll jump in. I think essentially in summary fashion, we've got some good news here. Our subcommittee has met two times. That was Eric Galimo and Andrew Gunther. We also had Dean Chaddix, not here with us today, but representing construction and inspection, Diana and myself. We did go back and do some research. The SWE fee came on in April of 2012, so we got into about the 2.5 years worth of data that was available to us, including the three building seasons. And I'd say long and short, we did realize that the fee revenue was running ahead of the cost to do the work. I'd say in a general summary there, I think, going in, kind of worst case scenarios are chosen in this, where you might look at, how costly or onerous the permit compliance may be. I think there might have been assumptions of needing to dedicate a full-time employee, truck, equipment, so on and so forth. It was solely dedicated to that, going site to site. And as we've gotten into the work, we've just realized that's not been the case. There might have been some anticipation, maybe with some struggles with contractors and whatnot. But I'd say by and large, for the most part, the contractors are doing very well. there, and I think coupled with that in our construction management group, they have been able to realize some efficiencies to parallel this work with other work that the inspector was already doing with the development inspection. So with that, we went back to the fee table, and the burdensome part of this seemed to be towards the smaller projects. So in the end, we looked at, as you see here, Diana has done an update for us. If you have that sheet, you should see the MPDS erosion control fees. On the front page of that, she's colored in red there, the far column to the right, where we're proposing to drop the base fee, initial base fee, from $450 down to $350. We take a significant reduction in the first acre of disturbed area from $2,000 per acre down to $1,000 per acre, and then also similar to that in the 1 to 5 acres, we put that and have $700 to $350, and kept the fees remaining the same therefrom. Coupled with that, Diana ran a couple of different scenarios. We did one with a very large site, 163-acre site. You see the numbers there. That equates to about $2,500 savings, or about a 14% reduction. Smaller projects will realize a much higher percentage of reduction. A very small site, a 0.6-acre site, is going to save you about $700. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's about 40% reduction on what it would have been. And then more of a medium-sized site there, the last example, 2.34 acres, final savings there of $1,569, or about a 45% decrease. So I meant to also add, part of the language when the fee structure was initially set up was that DEEB would take a look at the progression of the revenues and the costs and so forth, and revisit that. So in essence, we're fulfilling what we committed to do. And I'd like to say that same principle will remain in place. We think that these are realistic numbers. We don't want to create some kind of a nosedive here, and we don't think we're headed to that, but more of a soft landing where we come in and really narrow the gap there between fees received and or charged and the cost to do the work. So we do think this gets us closer. We are going to propose to use those adjusted fees downward, and again watch that for at least a year, perhaps two, and then maybe come back and take a look at it. So I'd say, with if Deeb concurs with this, the next step would be I will need to revisit this with the Public Works Director. I've given some indication to him already that we are doing some preliminary work on this, so he knows it's coming. And take it to the Director, who I then think will start to visit that with the Board. So.
Move
approval.
Second.
Great job.
Any discussion?
That's
great work, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Thanks, staff, for all their hard work on it. I think what we have here at the end of the day is something that's more in line with the effort that's coming to take.
Yeah. Very good. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Abstained? None so. Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Very good.
That just pops back up.
No, I
just
I
just wait.
With my heart in two eyes, I did not want to know that. I wondered whether it came off that way.
Okay. Jamie, you're up again, man. Big day for you.
There we go. Well, so I think from the last time we met, I haven't circled back with Marty yet. I wanted to take an opportunity to go talk with folks on the banking side, as well as Terry Wallum had asked me to talk to some other folks. And so I had that opportunity to do that, and they've relayed to me some concerns. But I think with that, I still think from the industry perspective is we would still like to try to push the time frame out as far as we can. So at that end, I've got to get to go back with Marty and get our proposal ironed out to move forward with.
That you've been discussing has this been discussion been ongoing with the industry?
I have my direction from the board there.
Okay.
The additional conversations, I think, were related out of some concerns that this board had raised last time we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and talked to the banker, talked to the title person, and have got their perspective on it. I guess I'm comfortable enough that doesn't change what I think the industry would be seeking.
Okay.
So the last one was getting it extended out about insulation, was that right?
Yeah. That one kind of died.
It wasn't incremental enough benefit.
It was a lot more work for very small. Unless you don't have to finance it at all.
Right.
It really wasn't worth it.
I agree.
Right.
I think the worst finding was.
Okay.
It would be at sale or final occupancy.
Okay. So you're going to continue to have discussion with staff on that and see where
you're going? Yeah, and it's I dropped the ball. I had late conversations with the banker because he's hard to get a hold of.
Okay. November, December, November's filling up. Well, we've got what,
if
three, at least four.
We got four now.
Just because I've had this conversation for years now with other folks around the state and other interested parties. If it's at inspection, okay, that's fine. But if it's at sale or closing, the money people start freaking out. You know, you got to make sure that there's financial surety that impact fee will be collected before people take possession of the property. And more than any other group, I'm sure that the school districts would be very nervous about that proposition.
Yeah, and I think from the industry's perspective, when talking with my direction from the board there, I think the initial thing is to try this as a demonstration on non-school impact fees. We can demonstrate success, we can go to them and partner with them to show that it works.
Okay.
Your turn.
Maybe what we can do then is follow up with you as we get closer to our November meeting.
That would be great.
And see if you're ready yet, and if not, maybe push out to December.
Okay.
I believe we made it.
Yeah, we did.
We got back on track.
Oh, we're early, actually. I do know that there is going to be some public comment this afternoon, so I will, if there's nothing else from the board, I'll open it up for public comment. Paul?
My name is Paul Williams, and I'm with Columbia Northwest Engineering. I tried to email everybody on the board about the talk today. I'm sorry if you didn't receive my email. But I do have a handout.
This is the same stuff you sent me.
Yes.
Is yours.
So what's in front of you is a resolution. It's a tool that you can use to see if there's going to be looking at a possible cross circulation or right away possible requirements. And looking through the document, looking at the criteria on the project.
Can you copy?
Actually, back up a little bit. Real quick, the methodology on what is used, the data you collect, to analyze your project to go on all four. So what you do is, if you have a project, it's going to generate so many ADT, so you capture that number, and then you calculate the public right away, you divide those numbers, and in this resolution document, they have a graph that you just kind of see where your number is at. And if you're on one side of the graph, you can show that
those improvements, if you're on the other side of the graph, there's a chance that, you know, that project will need that recovery farm, either right away or cross circulation. So I have a project that's high density, so I went ahead and put a table together and just kind of broke it down into different densities, because different densities, this is an assumption that's based on, they're all built on the same roadway cross section, which is the local access. And during, kind of through my research, I found that majority of these places are built with, you know, local access. So really what the difference is the frontage width for each zoning. And so I went and looked at it and did the calculations and found that the median density grew really nicely with the equation. Then when we started looking at low density, it started to fall off. So I just recently got the presentation, you know, that and this is what I'm looking for, is input from Deeb on, you know, the, what was the nexus in the data set. And so looking through that data, it, to me it looked like it was for low-density residential. And so what I did was I did some research on my own. I looked at, I just picked R18. I went through and looked at R18 properties through Clark County, and I started at 2000 because, just like Eric was talking about, as engineers, we like to collect data. Most importantly, we like to generate an equation, and then most importantly, test the equation. So I wanted to collect, you know, as much data about R18. When you look at the data set here, for the, I believe is for low density, there's 40 data sets to generate this curve. So I started from 2000 to present and looked at a few high-density residential, only came up with 8 projects. But there's a significant difference between high-density and low-density is the network system. Some of these were built on private systems, and if the notion is behind it is you're selling out right away, that kind of skews the data set. So I went back to 1995 to present and only came up with 18 projects that had been built, you know, since 1995 to here. But once again, I had a majority of my data sets were basically zeros, and a small handful that actually could generate some numbers, which really don't apply to this. So almost all of them fall off into the chart. But I tried to generate a curve, you know, to come here to maybe present, you know, a new curve for high density. But I just don't feel comfortable with the data set. It's just not enough. You know.
So you only found 18 developments that were done in the R18 zone,
yes,
since 94?
95. I can forward you that.
Are you distinguishing between multifamily and single family?
No, R18.
Okay, just the subdivision versus site plan? That's kind of what I mean.
No, because in that data set, even that data set is so small.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I think there's only a total, in my R18, I think there's only a total of 4 apartment complexes.
Okay, so most of those have then been developed as either townhome or single family.
Right, but some of those townhomes have been built off of private systems versus a public. Instead of building a public network, they built a private system, a private network.
Okay. And so, Paul, what's the kind of the bottom line that you're
looking at? So when you're looking through this document, you know, it just says residential. You know, that's pretty vague.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, high density, low density, residential, because you would like to have a cookie cutter, you know, approach to this. You know, something that, you know, doesn't really necessarily need an engineer to, you know, digest these numbers, but when you start to really dive into it, there definitely is a distinct difference between high density and low density.
With regards to rough proportionality?
Yeah, rough proportionality.
But rough proportionality being based on the square footage
of right-of-way.
Of right-of-way.
Compared to the ADT. Because ADT is going to be the same across, you know, the same zone. So those are going to be the common, you know, denominator.
Right.
The whole approach. The only thing that's going to be different is public right-of-way or private right-of-way.
So there's going to be a higher ADT in an R18 development as opposed to an R175 just
yes.
because of the density.
Yes.
That's
why it starts to really skew the data almost off the chart.
Okay. Eric, you remember this coming through and what the discussion was?
I actually dug up all the information. So I have the data set here too. But just real quick, I don't know that this is even... The purpose of this proportionality study was for road modification determinations when... And it was primarily for frontage improvements. And when you're looking at road mod justifying it based on proportionality, that's not the only category you can use in a road modification. There's a lot of categories. So when you're looking at proportionality, you're looking at, you know, normally proportionality is based on fairly small projects where you're doing it. Most of these came out with frontage improvements. It mentions cross circulation, but I don't think it's really cross circulation roadways. It's more roadways through the site. It's not really meant to be a proportionality for providing circulation. It was more, do you need to build a road at all? Even if it's needed, do you need to build it, or could you do a road mod to not build it and let it get right away instead? So it's almost being taken, I think, out of context. I don't know if by staff or by, you know, the applicant who is doing the road mod, but in your particular case, because you sent me some information ahead of time, I don't think this is a proportionality issue at all. I think it's a cross-circulation issue. And looking at, is cross-circulation needed in this case? It's not really, is it proportional to the site? It's, you know, cross-circulation in general is set up more for the public road system. Multifamily and commercial, multifamily in particular, is always challenging with cross-circulation because they tend to be not served by the public road system. It's served by aisles and parking lot, but a lot of times there's security, so there's gates, and they tend to be a big problem for circulation. They just don't fit the mold. So I think that's the real problem. But I'll continue on this. But I can give you the history on this. This was meant more for road modifications where you're looking at getting out of frontage improvements or even through streets based on the cost of the improvement, not the need for circulation. It's a little different context.
So would this apply for a high-density right-of-way?
If you were doing your frontage improvement, sure, if you had a project, and it was an apartment complex, and you're on a frontage, and you didn't want to build that frontage because of the proportionate impact to it, yes, you can apply for it, but I almost guarantee it's the size of the project. If you're doing multifamily, and you're over, like,
I mean, will it fit into the equation?
I can tell you, you had the data set. I don't think any apartments were on the data set. It was almost all single family.
Yeah, it was
because
all.
Because that's the data set they had. I have a copy of it here. It's in the back of here. And Steve Schulte did it. He really likes statistics. He had this amount of information. And I have this data set right here.
Yeah, I just finally got the information from that. And I did look. When I was looking through that data set, it was all to me because it's all low density.
That's really
yeah.
No R18, no R22, no
R40. But do we even need to look at high density in that regard? Because even if it is for low density, you have a higher EDP with higher density, you're going to then have a... it would seem to me in I have to tell you right now, I'm not the expert as far as this kind of stuff is concerned. Yeah. That's why I'm kind of leaving it up to the engineers to kind of, or those that are more statistically inclined, that it would seem to me that you would almost always be having to, you would never not meet the rough proportionality in a multi-family development.
Unless it's really small. I can see a four-lot apartment complex. You can do it.
But is that something that might come out not proportionally? Is that something that we should be applying? Should we be applying this to
it's
or should we be coming up with different criteria?
Yeah. So one thing to clarify, this is not a requirement saying if you meet the proportionality, you have to do the frontage improvements. And the county shouldn't be using it that way, in my opinion. They shouldn't be saying you have to build it because you meet proportionality. This was meant as a test if an applicant was requesting to not build something based on our proportionality. It would be analyzed. This would be some guidance where previously nothing was out there. When you say, hey, what does proportional really mean? So Steve looked at all the data and said, well, this is typically what it is, but this isn't a requirement for the county. There shouldn't be saying you have to build it because you're proportional. There's other reasons to not be, have to build a roadway. In your case, I would make a strong argument based on circulation and the type of development. Because multifamily is sort of different than single family.
Now, I'm not sure if it's the same era, but there were lawsuits where the county actually insisted on a road going through to properties that were. There were actually some legal cases.
Yes.
I think that may be what this is kind of addressing. Was actually accessing the property that was not all. I mean, it was like to connect streets, basically across regulation.
So, Paul, what would you propose then?
Well, it'd be nice. I mean, here's a tool. So feel confident it's on low density. This is a tool. If I want to use it to, do a justification like that, it'd be nice if I had a tool for high density. Based on the same principles and concepts.
Right. Okay. Ali.
Yeah. Actually, I have a little problem with the philosophy. The purpose of the proportionality is the impact of the development on public roads, and the proportionate share of the development. I mean, the proportion of any development needs to be done by the development. So my problem is that one trip to an apartment complex, I don't see any difference with one trip to a residential one. They both have the same impact on the public transportation system and the street. So, and at the same time, 6.27 ADT per apartment unit is less than 9.55 or 59, I guess, 55 for the residential unit. So you already have a lower ADT for each unit because there are not less cars. That people want to occupy an apartment unit. But again, my issue is one trip out of an apartment and one trip out of a residential unit has the same impact on the public road. So the proportionate share should be the same regardless of the high density or low density.
Paul, is this just a moment? Sorry, Ali. Is this an apartment project or is this a subdivision project?
This is an apartment complex. That's why I tried to, provide a table.
Okay.
It's the difference between high density and low density is huge.
Okay.
You know when you take into consideration.
Okay. Go ahead, Ali. I that's one thing I don't think we need.
Again, I don't understand the issue why an apartment complex should not be obligated as much as the residential development to provide public transportation system or A2RD or BLD just based on the density, because the impact on the roads are the same. One ADT, again, from the apartment complex has the same impact on the road system and transportation system as one ADT from a single family resident. As long as you break it down to ADT, you're good. But if you're going to look at the size of the project or number of units, I think there might be some argument there. But ADT to ADT should not really matter.
But that's what is the common denominator here, though, is that I think that's what Paul's saying, is that there's a disconnect in the ADT, that common denominator, because they're using the 9.57 here for all multifamily development, whereas the ADT, which is part of the equation for multifamily apartments, is lower and may end up with a different end result.
Yeah.
But when you divide the square footage, the ADT, it come out even. For example, 160 square feet of improvement according to this study, which is adopted by the board.
Mm-hmm.
160 square feet of improvement is proportional to one ADT. So if you have 6.27 in the apartment complex, you multiply that by 160, and then 9.55 for a single family by 160. You end up with the higher square footage for a single family versus a single apartment unit. But again, once you look at it on an ADT to ADT basis and a square footage to a square footage, again, I didn't see the action on that issue that they should be looked at frequently.
And I'm to understand this is more.
I mean, I would like to know if there is something I'm missing. I'm being honest.
Sure.
So I don't get it. So.
Okay. Sorry. No, that's quite all right. I mean, it's a good explanation, and maybe Paul. I certainly don't know enough about this to from a personal standpoint, and it looks like this has come before Deeb in the past. I might suggest if you have something that you might want to propose with regards to a different data set that can be used similarly for multifamily developments, and whether when we kind of using this over this proportional share or whatever, regardless of whether it's for right of way, frontage improvements, right of way dedication, or cross circulation, do you think you could maybe propose something to staff to say, hey, by the way, this is neat and this has been a one size fits all, but it fails to recognize the difference in the ADT associated with multifamily. Maybe when you do the calculations, you find that you're right back to square one, but
the numbers that keep falling into the 160, that's based off of low density. So if you created a high density equation, you would come up with a different number. So they come up with some cutoff points in the document, on the very top paragraph, or second paragraph. So 260 and greater per, and so they're breaking it down to per ADT. So 260 square feet, and that's why I created a table here to kind of show you, and that's for right-of-way frontage improvements, but for cross-circulation requirement, it's 160. So if I'm an R120, mm-hmm. and I develop at what the zoning requirement is for 100-foot, width frontage improvements, half was 23, I'm already at 240. I mean, right there, I can justify not having to do a cross-circulation. But if I go down to an R30, my number comes out now to be 96. So we're not even in the same ballpark.
Right now, this is based on...
These cutoff numbers are based off of low density. So the low density curve generates these numbers.
Okay. And this is also based on the frontage width per lot.
Yes.
And in multifamily apartments, you don't have that.
So you're going to have, like I said, if I'm looking at these R30s and R18s, you're going to have a good data set that has zero. Whereas when they were looking at these low density, not a single one of those were built on a public network. They're all built on a public, so they're
on a private.
40 data sets. Mm-hmm. So that's able enough information to generate a curve that you can have confidence in.
Okay. I don't know if anybody else on the board has any comments on that. It seems to me that, Paul, if there is something in this policy or code now that you feel is flawed with regards to staff's ability to objectively make a determination on whether rough proportionality is met or not, is there another alternative way that you are proposing to look at that from a multifamily apartment standpoint? Or are we just looking at this and saying this shouldn't apply because the data set was all for low density residential?
I don't think
individual
is the county requiring you to build based on your proportional, so you have to do it?
No.
Or at least, is that what they're saying? Because if so, I would say the county was using it.
No, actually, people there have been a lot of activity as the resolution since the board decided in order to stop in Capsa 4, which is unique in the entire nation. You cannot find this study or this type of resolution anyway, because it is kind of like a gray area when it comes to proportionality.
Yeah.
A lot of people used to compare dollar amount with the your impact. There has been a lot of formulas. So we hired Volta. It took about a couple of years to study all the development and look at what the other development have been able to do without having to the decision or actually going and doing it, which indicates that we can see job. Collect those data and try to make sense out of how much they could do the ADT. And that's why we came up with this. The only purpose of this is through roadmap. There is no place in the code that you could use this, except that there are five criteria in the roadmap approval. And this is one of them that you could say, you know, you're asking too much. If you have a formula short of that and 300 feet of frontage, this formula would show you very, very, very out of proportion if you ask them to do anything. But when it comes to like 100 lot subdivision, you're going to have a hard time to say, I'm going to put in 100 units and I'm not going to do the sidewalk or I'm not going to do the widening. Yeah. It is not perfect, it's not exact science, but it's the best we have. And I encourage anybody to bring up any other way and alternative and present it to say, if we think this is more logical, more feasible. And you guys can, you know, MCAD it. And, it takes a lot of effort, I must tell you. I don't think the county can afford to spend that type of money that we need and spend this staff time, especially these busy days. But if somebody is willing to take it on, maybe call it. That's not the point.
With all your freaks.
I mentioned it earlier, but just to kind of, I agree with part of what Paul's looking to do, and then I disagree with other pieces. One, I think this is the wrong tool. I think we're barking up the wrong tree with trying to justify not going roadway based on the route proportionality and apartment complex. I think that's the wrong criteria. I've done a lot of apartments, quite a few over the last year, and circulation is always an issue with apartments. I have to say, probably on at least 60% of those apartments, we had to go for a road modification over cross circulation. And it's based on what the cross circulation code has done. And it doesn't really take into account the unique development, the unique challenges with multifamily for apartments. If you're doing a townhouse development in an R18 or an R22, you serve those off the public roadway. When you're doing an apartment complex, what's unique about it is typically you're not served off roadway. So if you put a roadway right in the middle, it bisects the commercial availability use of the site.
Yeah.
You have a roadway in the middle, you have to meet setbacks, yeah. And then you can't serve your apartments off those roadways because you can't park off them. So then you have to duplicate roads right off of it. It's not appropriate for that type of development. Mm-hmm. So when you're zoning land, multifamily, you have to take that account with how the circulation is going to happen. And a lot of times, those pieces don't talk. So I've been successful getting a lot of road miles approved in multifamily apartment land based on other criteria, not proportionality. I based it on circulation in general, the type of development. And I would encourage, I guess, from this discussion, for staff and the applicant to look at it that way. And if you'd like an opinion on a road modification in particular, maybe the deep, because that is one of our things, is to like kind of like an appeal board for engineering issues. It could come to us for an opinion. We could offer that based on that for the road modification, whether it's appropriate or not. But I kind of think we're wasting our time if we go through and redo all the speech stuff. And really, this is guidance. I think really the resolution is okay. And circulation.
This is a good tool. This honestly is a good tool for low density. I can create a curve for high density. It's just not going to have the data set. The intense data set that you have for business.
We're running into that with other issues we're dealing with too.
So I mean, so when you generally have that much data set, mm-hmm. it's easier to get into that file. When you try to generate a curve, then arguments will start to occur.
Yeah.
But we can maybe at the end of the day we can all agree that here's all we do is just attach, you know, additional curves to this already.
And maybe that's what needs to take place, but as we've been discussing with the infrastructural percentage, it looks like this is another one of those examples that it's going to take some time in order to get the data set that you're going to need in order to prove one way or another or whether this needs to change at all. But I don't know if there's anything that the DEEP can do today to further this along. And as Eric says, I think that we would encourage you to work with staff on your individual project-based issue, whether it's one way or the other, whether it's frontage improvements or cross-circulation or whatever. But I don't think we have enough information here today or
to look at this, because it looks to me like it's apples and oranges. While it's the same zoning, it's not the same development type, and that, you're right, doesn't fit in there, but unfortunately, this is what it is. So.
I saw your route, but not everyone here has what you submitted. I have a circulation plan. I agree with what you're saying on the circulation plan. There's constraints here. There's reasons why cutting this up makes this project impractical to develop. So if you have good things in your roadmap, I would go out in a different direction. And I wouldn't hang your hat on proper personality.
Would you, Chris, would you mind if I emailed you the road model? Would you take a look at it? I'm looking for help.
Sure. Like Eric said, and I didn't know that the deed was, that was part of our purview, but I might recommend that you try to do what you can with staff. Get an initial, if staff would allow, an initial buy-off on what their recommendation would be, and then come and present it to the board. A member individually, we're a board, and we can't just work on an island each individually. You can email it to the board.
Yeah, I'm going to email it to the board.
Yeah, and then we can discuss whether this is something that is within our purview for our bylaws to be able to take up, depending on the recommendation from staff. That's the best I can do for you right now.
Is this gated? Are you trying to gate this?
We're thinking about gating it.
If it's not gated, I think it makes it a lot easier for circulation, because there's probably other ways to do the routes. And a big challenge is always, if there's provisions in the code, and it acknowledges, it says an ideal block length, but it also acknowledges other constraints, and it gives, even though it's constricted, what about pedestrians? So if you gated it for automobiles, you can kind of gate it for pedestrians as well. So I can tell you, I ran into a situation in the city, there is no way this. We ended up going through quite a bit of road on, and we ended up not going the road, but we find some sidewalk circulation. So we could at least make sure we didn't. There's two pieces of circulation, but one is making sure that vehicles are not really, in my opinion, and people differ depending on circulation, is make sure you don't landmark crossings. And they all have access to the circuit, the grid, basically. So you don't want to landmark somebody, and you also want to make sure pedestrians don't have to walk in front. But that's kind of the two things I measure circulation on typically.
So we've been able to provide some guidance, I guess, as far as some alternatives that you can take. But for right now, we really can't take it up until we have something else in front of us, whether it's a recommendation from staff on the road modification or additional information that you can provide, which looks like, I guess we're just going to have to kind of leave that up to you.
Yeah, no, I'd love to provide additional information for input from the
Okay. And if time allows, at our next meeting or two, during public comment, we'll and if you want to put it on the agenda, you can request that, and I'll pull the board, and we'll see how we feel about that.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you for coming today. I mean, it sounds like it's something that might need to be addressed at some point in time, but for right now, we'll kind of play it how it is. Any other public comment? None seen. We're adjourned.
Thank you, Mike.
Oh, you're welcome.
Oh, Rosie, thank you.
Thank you. See you later. Thank you.